As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to Front and Nationwide. This is The Athletic's dedicated Blue Jackets podcast. Aaron Portzine with you. Allison Lukian is here.
Hello.
And we hope you had a great Thanksgiving. Hope you enjoyed our podcast last week where we put together a bunch of thankful thoughts from people around the Blue Jackets and around hockey. We're going to change gears again on you this week with an informative one. Our guest today is Mark Cameron. He is an associate professor in the Department of Population and Quantitative Health Sciences at Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine. If that name, that title sounds familiar, it's because Cameron has been quoted numerous times in numerous outlets and has perhaps because he's been a guest on this program previously. We last spoke on May 29th, just a few days after the NHL announced plans to set up two bubble locations to play the remainder of the 2019-20 season. It worked very well. It allowed the league to award the Stanley Cup to the Tampa Bay Lightning. Of course, the Blue Jackets played in the bubble and lasted two rounds before they exited to the Lightning. Dr. Cameron's back with us now after 5 months, and the league is again looking for a way to start playing games again. Only now they're trying to start the 2021 season, which is already 2 months delayed. We want to explore the challenges now, given the recent explosion of cases in this country. And we want to discuss what we've learned about the virus since we last discussed it. Is a person immune after contracting and surviving the virus? How soon could vaccines be available to the mass population such that a large crowd could safely gather in indoor buildings? That's, of course, what the NHL would require. We'll get into all of that and much, much more in the next little while. Dr. Cameron, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for welcoming back. It's great to talk to you again about this.
Excellent. On the day we last spoke on this podcast, May 29th, and I looked this up, I promise you I don't have it memorized, there were 651 new COVID cases in Ohio. This is Thursday, December 3rd, so with yesterday's numbers Wednesday, there were over 9,000 new cases. That's obviously quite an exponential growth. Yeah. If the NHL deemed it necessary to play in a bubble back then, what should they be looking at now? This is just Ohio. Those are just Ohio numbers. This league is obviously bigger than Ohio, and it's different in different cities. And really, it's different in Canada than it is in the U.S. But I think it's safe to say that the numbers are significantly higher everywhere. What challenges does this league face now?
Yeah, so we are indeed in a very, very challenging phase of this pandemic. As you say, the last time we spoke, which was somewhat before our second wave even started. And that wave, which went through the summer, peaked at twice the number of daily new cases than our April-May peak. So even when we were last speaking, there was worse ahead of us than what was behind us. Now, where are we now? We did deal with our second surge, both nationally and in Ohio. In Ohio, we managed to right the ship and get past our second peak, mainly by mask mandates and a reinvigoration of the precautions that we were taking. However, by September, as we went back to some other type of activities, most notably back to university campuses, back to schools, back to other forms of business, we invited this third surge that we're experiencing right now. And it is especially bad because the timing was perfect alongside the normal start of the cold and flu season, which is predictably upon us in October each and every year. So where are we today? We haven't even had signs of a peak for this third surge, whether we're talking in Ohio or nationally. And we are beyond, you know, four, five, six times the peak that we had over the summer. So what does that mean to a national league, whether it's the NHL or something like the MLS, who is trying to implement their postseason plan? Well, the virus is in our communities more than it ever has been. And the leagues have to take that into consideration, as well as the infection mitigation within the teams, and how that interplay between team, delegates, the fans, and the community surrounding each and every one. They have to consider all of those aspects of safety during this pandemic. And the choices we might have had back when we first talked and the NHL entered their bubble, or even earlier in the fall, in terms of how we can return to play safely and limit the number of cases that might be caused therein. Right now, all of those are off the table. We are in a very dangerous part of this pandemic, and that has to be included in everyone's plan, whether it's a national sports league or you know, something more locally or statewide.
Now, there was some mystery early on in this nightmare as to whether or not the body created antibodies after contracting this virus. What have we learned about that? Does the body fight this a second time? How long does it fight it? And I ask this question because I think, A, it goes to how many people would need to get the vaccine, and B, how long-term effect of the vaccine may be. Is it going to be like the flu shot where it's required every year based upon the anticipated strain? Do we know what the body does in terms of antibodies to fight future infections of the same COVID-19?
Well, we have learned two things. First of all, we have learned that we have a lot to learn, and we have a lot to learn still about this virus, its behavior, and how we can control it, treat people, and prevent future outbreaks or surges. The second thing we've learned about this virus is the exception is the rule. So the traditional sense of immunology and infection versus immunity and vaccination, all of those traditional thoughts on how we can gain protection against a virus, whether we get the virus and are immune to it afterwards, or we are vaccinated against it and we don't get it in the first place. All of those lessons have gone out the window. First of all, people that get the natural infection, they don't show very good antibody levels after clearing the virus. So the way that we see it right now is people who get COVID-19 and recover are not immune necessarily to the virus if they get exposed again, or they might have partial immunity only. What does that mean? Well, it means that somebody who gets COVID today and recovers can't count on not getting infected if they are exposed again. So that's one important lesson which has surprised us. Second of all, the vaccines, well, they're brand new. They've been luckily proven very safe in phase three clinical trials. They've been proven very effective as well in preventing new infections, especially severe infections. But because of what I said earlier about this virus not giving us good immunity in the long run, the vaccine may not give us good immunity in the long run, whether that's months or years. So in terms of how we look at this in the future, we're going to have to continue to study it. We're going to have to continue to modify our plans and our knowledge about this virus. We may have to take boosters regularly for the vaccine to maintain immunity over time until this virus's back is broken and it's gone out of our population. Or the people who are infected and get better will also have to take that vaccine and be still diligent about the precautions they're taking to prevent transmission in amongst us, because we may become infected again. So these are very different qualities for a pandemic a virus of this nature. And they're going to have to be built into all of these plans, again, whether a national sports league or something more local from your public health department. This is going to be a challenge to all of those organizations because they're going to have to be flexible as we learn more about this virus and how to protect ourselves.
Wow. Dr. Cameron, and I imagine this is probably an evolving story for you as well, but you know, there has been some discussion that obviously people are recovering from their experience with the virus. Often people who are quote unquote younger or healthier seem to have an edge sometimes, but we're also seeing work that reveals possible long-term effects. And when we think about athletes, you know, that can be the difference in having a job that you've worked your whole life to have or not. What can you share with us about what you're learning about the long-term effects of this virus? Even if someone survives their experience with it, what do they have to be worried about after that?
Yes, this is a risk or a risk factor that has to be discussed and be built into these plans. The players themselves may be at risk for long-term impact of this infection, whether it's in their respiratory function or their cardiovascular function, or something as simple as, you know, after a bad illness, a bad flu, a more severe course of COVID-19, things like muscle aches, lethargy, exhaustion, those symptoms are quite common and they can last for weeks afterwards. And then there's the idea of a long hauler type of patient post-COVID who can experience these issues in their health and fitness for quite a while, even months. And, you know, we're not enough into this pandemic and its impacts on people long-term to really know or to advise on what could happen even in young, healthy individuals. So there's a lot of concern, not only for, you know, athletes and persons returning to play, whether a varsity, junior, high school, middle school, or national league, It's also what you're bringing in terms of additional risk across what might be months of post-play or post-illness impact to that particular person. So all of these unknowns, all of these serious impacts of this infection are certainly at the forefront of public health advisors and advisories for the general public, but also have to factor into how a league like the NHL returns to play and what acceptable levels of risk are included for the managers in the league, but also the players. I know the players are very aware of that type of interplay between the host, us, and the virus infecting us.
Sure.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
I think one of the, you talk about interplay, I think one of the most interesting maybe revelations, hopefully to so many people, is making decisions about how to handle this pandemic demands an intersection of economics, yeah, of ethics, and of health concerns. And you hear some of this sometimes when we hear about sports returning, and is it the right thing to do, quote unquote, to have testing resources go towards the athletes, or again, the economic boost of having professional sports return to play and how much that trickles down to so many businesses.
Yeah.
What can you share maybe about that thought process, or if you do have thoughts on how we appropriately weigh the economic benefits of bringing back a sport and dedicating resources that can help so many to athletes and to this part of our business world?
Right. You know, so you'll know from our last discussion and some of my other interviews that I've been generally supportive of well-conceived, well-monitored, flexible return to play plans. The way that some of those plans have played out at this point, some 6 to 8 months later in some of these cases, now gives us a body of evidence on how each plan has gone since, the number of cases that have arisen, the best ways to prevent infections within the leagues, and how to learn from the mistakes. Now, if we talked several months ago after that second surge, you know, there were more options left on the table. Okay, we know that masks work. We know that bubble organization surrounding a league or a season works. But we also know that each return to play plan, whether it's bubble or not, whether there's testing programs and flexible ways of dealing with infections that pop up within a team or an organization, we also know that each plan or return to play causes infections. That's been the constant. Each return to play plan, no matter how it's conceived and devised, has caused new infections. Now, with the NHL going into their their hub type bubbles playing last season out that way. There were infections as the teams prepared to go into the bubbles. But then once they did test and get into the bubbles, the rest of the season played out with little risk of infection. Same with the MLS plan, same with the NBA plan. Those bubble plans did work once the initial cases were cleared within that bubble. On the other hand, you know, the NFL has had these waves of cases make it into their teams, spread within the delegations, and travel with them when they've traveled to compete with other teams. The only thing that has been able to mitigate those outbreaks within a team is absolute flexibility in either canceling or rescheduling the games, and really putting either teams or series on pause. So we now know that, you know, a bubble plan works. Can we bring that into you know, the next NHL season? We now know how to test and recognize, and the limitations of that that testing program in terms of stopping infections at their source before they spread further in the teams. But still, we're on this backdrop that where we have to also consider where we're playing, the communities and the cities that these games will be played, because the virus is at, well, there are two different ways of looking at it. If you're looking at the community, the positive test rate in some states could be as high as 1 in 10 individuals who get a test for some reason are positive. So the virus is out there in the community at very high levels. If you're just, you know, looking at people randomly in the few surveillance type of studies that's been done, it's somewhere between 1 in 100 to 1 in 200 individuals are carrying the virus, whether they know it or not. So the bubble plan is really the best way to go forward. But right now, the fact that we are in this level of surge, really what I've been on my soapbox about mostly is, you know, develop these plans, get them in place. But for right now, the biggest question is, when do you restart the seasons? Because that really is the crux of the matter. The flexibility of the start date is the biggest consideration right now.
Doc, the NFL has and really college football too, have really teetered some weeks. Cancellations in the college ranks, postponements a lot in the pro ranks. And this is mostly, from what I can tell, players getting it from teammates in their facility. Mm-hmm. Do we know, can this be, I know that masks are not foolproof. They certainly dramatically help, but can you share this with sweat? Can you share this because hockey players running into each other, colliding, fighting, whatever, there's going to be a swapping of sweat if there's not a swapping of saliva.
Yeah.
How else can you get it through those means? And is just the act of playing football or playing hockey that has to, I'm guessing, if we're supposed to keep 6 feet away from people, literally running into people with great frequency, has to just send the likelihood of transfer skyrocketing. Is that correct?
Right. So, you know, first of all, the SARS coronavirus is spread by the respiratory, route. What has surprised us about the virus is it's not necessarily just respiratory droplets, like in a sneeze or a cough. This virus is able to transmit in air. It's not necessarily airborne, but it's able to travel on very small. They're called bioaerosols, meaning that it's not necessarily getting coughed on or sneezed on. The virus can hang in the air through, you know, the huffing and puffing of individuals, whether it's during play or singing or other types of physical activity. So when you're talking about players on the field, not wearing masks in close contact and really wafting by each other during play, that is a perfect storm of conditions for the virus to spread on that particular field. What was hoped originally was, okay, well, if you got people on there who have been tested for symptoms or tested for the virus at play, they would have low risk of being able to transmit the virus amongst themselves. As it turns out, it is a perfect environment for the virus to spread. Now, when you turn to the NHL, the reason why the cold and flu season comes up, especially in northern environments, is that as the air turns colder and drier, and we return indoors and congregate more closely, whether it's a family or a set of friends and family or a sports organization, the virus is going to be able to get amongst us easily because we're closer together. But more importantly, it's able to travel on air currents and survive in this aerosol means of spread for longer periods of time. In fact, there's a CDC case study out just a few weeks ago where a super spreader event occurred at a hockey game where all other precautions had been taken, no masks on the ice, but the play was where the infection spread from one individual to the majority of the other players on that rink because of the cold, dry air, the exertion of the players, and the fact that they're really skating by each other and have contact play throughout that period for that amount of time. So the NHL has to consider those types of mechanisms of spread that we now have evidence of in terms of the risk of those players on the ice or in any other league. With the football examples that we were just talking about, with the Big Ten plan to return to play and the NFL return to play, some of those factors didn't exist in terms of, you know, cold, dry air and rink play. However, the Big Ten, for example, plan was designed to be very, very objective. It relied on cold, hard data in terms of how decisions would be made, whether to pause a play or to pause a team or to indeed shut down the league if the proportion of players or the proportion of people in their delegations rose beyond a certain level. Those were very, those numbers were set in stone. So they were able to act objectively to revise their schedule and cancel games or reschedule them and react accordingly. The NFL didn't have that type of component of it. So that's another lesson to be learned potentially by the NHL, is how to design a plan that is objective and driven by the data and includes the infection within the community and their delegates and how they're going to react if that gets slightly out of control. Really, those are the difficult bullet points of what this return to play plan for the next season has to involve.
Yeah, so there was a report today confirmed by The Athletic's Pierre LeBrun that four NHL teams have looked at ways to play their home games outside.
Yeah.
Boston, Pittsburgh, and surprisingly, Anaheim, Los Angeles. and I this stems certainly towards trying to get people into their games to charge tickets. in football stadiums, these massive football stadiums, I think Cleveland's allowed 5,000 fans. Some places they've allowed 10,000 fans. They're spaced out throughout the football stadium. I believe these are all roofless football stadiums, not domes.
Right.
Is there any way that the NHL could have limited fans in attendance spaced from section to section without the vaccine having taken hold?
So the short answer to that, and, you know, I'm as disappointed as the next person is right now, absolutely not. The presence of this virus in our community might mean that every one in 100 or one in every 200 people that attend that event at any capacity are going to be infected, whether they know it or not. Now, that might be fine with the standard precautions and, you know, sitting in the stands far away from the next group of people. But time and time again, what we've seen is that may not be where they transmit the infection. It is getting to the stadium, public transit, going through the turnstiles, using public bathrooms and public facilities. You cannot guarantee the safety of those fans with that type of plan. Not now. Maybe, you know, as we went through the troughs of these surges where the case numbers, the test positivity rates were at its trough, at the lowest levels, especially in Ohio. Ohio, you know, has turned its surges around a couple times. We know how to do that. But right now, the virus is way too prevalent in the community to consider gathering people, whether it's just the team and its coach staff and managers, but certainly not the people that would come to see the game. To me, that is a level of risk that we cannot take right now. So where's the bright spot of this? Again, it's flexibility with that plan and objectivity in implementing it and the right timing. Can we get past the holidays coming up and get past our peak in January and February? You know, we have to be looking at that data very closely. I don't think we will be past our peak this time until, you know, well into January, maybe into February. The holidays are going to cause a shoulder or a repeak of cases. We know that for sure. We've seen them with each major holiday, including Thanksgiving. In Canada, that was especially true because they had it earlier in the fall and there was a uptick in cases. We have to get past this third surge to even consider bringing fans back into the stands. And again, and we should talk about that next, until this herd immunity is grown properly with this mass rollout of a vaccine.
You're reading my mind, Dr. Cameron, we're in such a strange time, right? Because we know these surges are coming, and yet we know we're also so much closer to a vaccine. There's been talk of, and I've seen some even event producers talking about, you know, you'll be able to come into our events when you can provide proof of having been vaccinated. And I remember having to do that for school when I was little, but what are the ethical considerations there? Is there precedence for something like that to almost, you have to prove that you've been vaccinated to almost return to the world, so to speak?
Unfortunately, with this virus, having a vaccine card in your pocket is not proof of immunity. And that is the really perplexing, you know, aspect or phenomenon associated with this virus. So whether or not this type of measure could be put in place where, like, your driver's license, you know, has to be used, you know, but buying a case of beer at the local Target, Could you carry a I'm vaccinated card to show that you're immune and can be part of that normal everyday activity of watching a game? And wouldn't that be nice at this point of the pandemic to say, okay, well, if we get the vaccine, we can proceed knowing that we cannot be infected and we can proceed with confidence. Unfortunately, that's not true. The data is not in our hands yet. We know the vaccine is safe and effective, but we don't know how long that immunity could last. So if it gets to the point where, and the ethical questions are a whole other topic altogether in terms of people's personal health information and whether, you know, you can enforce a policy for people to declare what their health status is for sporting events. That's a whole other question. To me, it's moot because we don't know whether somebody vaccinated, especially if they haven't had the boost. The way that the vaccine is given is with two injections spaced about 3 or 4 weeks apart. And whether, you know, they can actually prove immunity when we know that that could be in doubt long term following an infection. That's just too high a burden, in my opinion, to put on people, to put on our health system, to prove that somebody is making lots of antibodies, reacted well to the vaccine, so that they are not at risk of being infected or carrying the infection further. We just don't know that at this point. The other part of this discussion is, when will us in the community be able to get our vaccine? Right now, they are very close in the U.S., for the FDA to approve emergency use of these vaccines, which is kind of a unfortunate term, but basically that means that people can be vaccinated outside of what they are now, which is in these phase three clinical trials. The priorities set so far is, okay, healthcare workers, people in long-term care facilities, i.e. the people that are most at risk right now of either getting and transmitting the virus because they care for patients, or are most at risk of dying from the infections, like our elderly. From there, the priorities go down. Basically, the decade of age that you are currently. So older individuals, whether they're in their 80s, 70s, 60s, 50s, will be the next batch of folks that get it. The athletes we're talking about, our young adults, our teenagers, the kind of core either player or sports fan, they will be last in line to get this virus, especially if there are, difficulties in distributing the vaccine. And there may be, given how these vaccines have to be cared for and distributed. So while, the people that are on the priority list may be seeing their vaccine starting very soon, but certainly by, March, April, May, into the spring, some of those priority groups will get their vaccine. But for enough of us to get it, especially healthy young adults, we're looking, we might be looking at the late spring and summer. So how does that really interleave with return to play, expecting that the virus will be more at bay because of the end of this wave we're in, or the vaccine being generally available and people being generally immune? It's still an open question. How short a season the NHL is willing to contemplate here really is, at issue. Do we want a replay of last season, or, do we want to, look at the data very closely and hope that we can start things up a little earlier? You see how complex this you know, this plan has to be.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
I remember reading about the 1918, the so-called Spanish flu.
Yeah.
And the number of people that believed it, and electricity, by the way, the spread of electricity to the parts of the country.
Yeah.
To be the work of the devil.
Yeah.
And would not wear a mask, would not, what we now call socially distance. And I remember thinking how silly that sounds and how ridiculous that sounds and how happy I was that it was 100 years later and we wouldn't confront that sort of thing today.
Right.
I guess what I'm asking you, Doc, is how are you holding up? Because there's, it's gotta be a frustrating exercise to be on the front line and to have dedicated your life to these things. And then when it hits our shores in a way that it has hit other countries, to have, I don't know what the number is, but it's too significant a number, mm-hmm, of people who just flat reject the things that we do know,
right,
about it. How are you holding up with that? How are the people that you know, certainly who are on the front line, holding up with that? How difficult is it?
Yeah, I mean, there's exhaustion at all levels, whether it's frontline healthcare worker, and they're certainly taking the brunt of this, but also researchers trying to figure out a cure, or these vaccines being developed, or better treatments for patients that get infected right now. In terms of public perception, when SARS hit Toronto in 2003, it really was the only city outside of Southeast Asia that was impacted that way. So for those of us that went through SARS then, the impact, the fear, the exhaustion that came along with, living with a virus like that in your city, in your community, and the economic impact of all of that was very real. And it stuck with a lot of us. And it's really been the impetus for our research since then. So, I can understand outside of that experience, why, or at least originally, the public may not have taken this virus as seriously as we should have, certainly. Different various levels of government didn't take it seriously either. And the messaging has been very inconsistent. But at this point, after, two surges and now well into the third, and with, tens of thousands of deaths occurring, more being piled on each and every day, with the science developed to the point that we're at now, even though we have a lot to learn, with the knowledge of this virus that we have right now, I don't understand. And it is it is frustrating, for me to provide advice and comments, some of which have been, the worst case scenarios have turned out to come true. I don't understand why there's still some, reluctance or disbelief in either what we can do about this virus or how serious this virus can be. Now, what it feels like right now, in talking to my colleagues or talking to my neighbors or other members of the community looking online, is this virus seems to be everywhere right now. So it is impacting more and more people. Until this virus hits home for some individuals, maybe it doesn't seem as real, but that's what's happening now. And it's a shame. It really is. And it's disappointing at all levels, not only, for us wanting to be sports fans back in that you know, arena, watching our favorite players on the ice, but also the simple matter of going out and having dinner with our friends or gathering in the holidays. All of those things are off the table. Now, you know, back to the bright spot of all of this, despite that challenge, despite the pushback, despite what's happening right now, science is catching up and we know a lot about what we can do. Masks work? Absolutely. The vaccine will be on hand soon? Absolutely. We can treat patients better now? Absolutely. The apparent case fatality rate of people who get COVID-19 has been going down from its April peak steadily. So we're doing better in terms of identifying people who A, have the infection, B, need special care, and getting them the treatment they need more and more. But the cold hard data is still the cold hard data. This is a dangerous virus that's killing people. And really for me, on the soapbox that I get on, and that's probably the wrong phrase to use because this is a real personal appeal to me, that every plan or return to daily activity, no matter how well intended, causes cases. And the issue is whether that's a child in school, a varsity player, or somebody in the NHL, that transmission map from one individual can go to two, can go to 10, and eventually get back to somebody who is vulnerable to that virus, whether having a comorbidity or being of a certain age. And then somebody is either at risk of a very severe illness or at risk of dying. And that is the sobering fact for every return to play or return to normal activity type of plan, especially right now when we know cases are bound to occur, either entering a bubble plan or occurring certainly outside of a bubble. So how do you balance all that? These are going to be very difficult decisions for these organizations, these managers, and the people at the top, how to debate all of that.
Dr. Cameron, thank you so much for joining us. Hopefully we can talk again in 5 months when this is a historical podcast looking back on the coronavirus. Maybe not 5 months, that's perhaps a little aggressive. Maybe in a year, this will be behind us and we can study it in the rearview mirror. I really appreciate your time as always, and thank you further for the work that you do.
You're welcome, and thanks for having me. You know, for me, it's always been getting good information out there, and you've helped a lot with that. Misinformation, as you said, has spread as fast or faster than good information. And getting the science out there and into these plans is really the goal here. We have to get past this, because the economic pain that we're having right now would be that much worse if we can't get this virus under control.
Excellent. Thanks so much for your time, Doc.
Thank you.